Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
What happens when your worst fear becomes your reality? Hi, I'm Brent Cassidy. Welcome to the Nightmare Success In and Out podcast, where we explore how to overcome your fears and nightmares and set yourself free. We're going to be exploring this topic with guys I was in Leavenworth with and others who survived their own nightmare. These stories can be inspiring, sometimes sad. There's some humor, but hopefully you can come away with a nugget of something that'll help you knock down some of the prisons you built up in your own mind. Nightmare Success In and Out, new podcast drop every Thursday. Wherever you get your podcasts, find me at BrentCasty.com.
This podcast involves topics such as violence, sex, and mental illness. If this might disturb you or those around you, please reconsider. It's okay. Privacy and confidentiality have been protected with personal information removed when possible. If you ever feel unsafe or suicidal, please call your local crisis center, emergency services, or national hotline. In the U.S., the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 988 or 1-800-273-8255. You matter.
Hey, this is Kate. I always tell guests when I record with them that I don't know when their episode will be released. And that is true. Stuff happens, I don't have a regular release date every week, and if it hasn't been made painfully obvious, my life has just a little extra chaos in it, and so I don't like to make promises I can't keep. That being said, the delay between the recording of this episode and today's release is much longer than I'm comfortable with. Normally, it's a couple weeks, maybe a month. This one I recorded back in May. That's way too long ago. And so, in advance, apologies because apologies are due, but especially because I was so excited about talking to this woman. Her name is Catherine Ramsland, and she is a forensic psychologist, so right up front, I think you understand why I was so excited. If you're a true crime person, you may, perhaps even should, have read some of her work or seen her on TV. And in early May, I got COVID. My whole family got COVID. It was just this whole thing in my house. And I was feeling pretty down and pretty gross and pretty sorry for myself. And so I sent out a handful of emails to people that I decided were probably way out of my league. Not remotely going to be interested in talking to some random stranger who's recording a podcast in my basement. And the number of people who said yes still blows my mind. There's a lesson there, I think, something to do with go ahead and ask, can't hurt. And it turns out they're wonderful, fantastic, smart, interesting people. And they spent time with me. And this is one of them. So, rather than continuing to prattle on, you'll hear it. You'll understand that this is someone whose mind and whose empathy I admire, and I hope I was able to meet her on some level with it, because I felt like we got each other. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss.
I'm Dr. Catherine Ramsland. I teach forensic psychology at DeSales University, where I'm also the assistant provost. My courses cover a lot of range, from death investigation to serial killers, to just basic forensics and behavioral criminology. And I'm also the author of 69 books, covering a wide range of things, but quite often lately, they've been largely about forensics, criminal behavior, extreme offenders, death investigations. And I'm embarking on a trilogy of novels starring a forensic psychologist who runs her own PI agency and takes on hard nuts to crack, so very twisty, weird cases. I'm also an executive producer for a show called Murder House Flip, which is a design show where we go into houses where murders occurred and redesign the murder space to allow homeowners to embrace their home and find peace there. And I was the executive producer of a four-part A&E show based on one of my books, which was Confession of a Serial Killer, The Untold Story of Dennis Rader, the BTK killer. And so I was, I guess, the star of that show, as well as one of the executive producers. So it's been very interesting to see things from the other side. And I hope to continue to write and to be involved in Hollywood productions.
I mean, I've read more of your things than I've watched, because I'm hard of hearing. And so watching is challenging, and I have, you know, my youngest kid is 9, and so it's probably best that I not watch at high volume around a 9-year-old. I really like how you write.
Thank you.
That it's clear without pandering.
Yeah. I try to be, I want to take difficult concepts and make them accessible to a lot of people. But I think of myself as a very clean writer, just get to it, not a lot of excess packaging. And to me, it's about communication with my reader always in mind.
What is, if people ask you, like, where do I start in your, I mean, 69 is a lot of books. What do you suggest people start with?
My books range over so many different things. I'm not sure. It depends on what their interest is. I wouldn't have them start on a serial killer book if they didn't want to read something like that. But, you know, I went undercover in the vampire subculture. I wrote a book about cemetery stories. I've written several paranormal-based books. One's called Ghost Investigating the Other Side, where I went around the country with ghost hunters, and then one of them co-wrote two books with me on paranormal forensics. I've written forensic science books, forensic psychology, true crime. There's so many different things that I've done that it's hard for me to say. A biography of Dean Koontz, for example, which is completely different. I wrote a book called Snap, Seizing Your Aha Moments, to write about how you can make these aha surprise insights. You can get them on a regular basis. So my book is helping you set up a program for that. I wrote a book about bliss and how that helps writers, and so all different kinds of things.
Do you have a favorite of your children?
It's always the one I'm working on. I love writing these novels because, and I have two other novel series. One's a couple of vampire novels. One is a couple of more fantasy suspense novels based around Jack the Ripper lore. One's called The Ripper Letter and the other is Track the Ripper instead of Jack the Ripper. I had a blast with that because I got to travel, go to London and Paris and all the sites that I talk about. Currently, I'm writing this other novel series, the Nutcracker series, because her agency is called the Nutcrackers, because that's what they do, is crack, take on cases. Some of those cases have paranormal components, although my psychologist is a skeptic. But she's willing to go look into all these things because she's aware that some odd things do happen and she wants to stay open. So that's always fun. And I get to travel to places that I write about. So I spent December in South and North Carolina exploring new places I hadn't seen. I went up to Concord, Massachusetts. I'll be going to Scotland. So I love that fiction. Even though I base it in real cases, every case that she takes on has a lot of real components to it. I love that I can travel and go explore things and meet new people. So I think all of my books, my favorite thing is meeting characters, meeting unusual people, and they become the basis for fictional characters. But often they're people I've actually met.
I gotta ask whether you've killed off a particularly obnoxious person in your life, fictionally speaking, because I would.
I have one in mind.
That's fair. That's as far as we need to go with that one. But that's I would. I would not be able to keep.
I definitely have had one in mind for a few years. It will happen.
Ideal. Absolutely ideal. You know, forensic psychology, do you get the reaction from people of, that's so cool, or that's so fascinating, you know, that this idea that, like, you chose your life's work based on how cool or interesting it is?
Yeah, and I didn't actually choose it. It was more circuitous than that. It wasn't what I set out to. I was teaching philosophy at Rutgers University. That's what I was doing and decided I wasn't going to do that anymore. I had tried experimental psych, where you cut off heads of rats and things like that. I didn't want to do that. I had been a counselor, a therapist. 2 years of that was enough for me. And then I saw this program in forensic psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And I thought, no, why don't I try that? Because I was writing at that time for a website called The Crime Library, which got taken over by Court TV. And that just seemed like a good complement to what I was doing. And it changed my life entirely. I did not expect to be a professor of forensic psychology. But to your point, I recently was at a very, very large crime conference called CrimeCon. And yeah, many people came, you know, paid to speak to me and ask me about forensic psychology and how can they become me? How can they do what I do? But what I do is very entrepreneurial. I mean, I talk to serial killers and people think that that's a job. It's not. It's not a job. It's an avocation at most. And it really, I don't do a lot of it. I don't talk to a lot of them. I choose some and go deep and spend a lot of time with them, years with them. But that is not part of the job. And I think that's the idea people have from TB, that's what it means to be a forensic psychologist. And they don't get that it's about assessments for the courts and things like that. They think it's, you know, you're profiling out there with the cops. Well, I do consult on death investigations with a coroner, but that's because of my background in suicidology. So I will do psychological autopsies. But again, it's not a job. It's here and there you get some work, and I don't even charge because I get cases for my classes. So that's just sort of a quid pro quo. And that's really what it's about. I mean, I think you make of this career what you want to, but if you're looking for it to support you, you're going to need to get into the more traditional areas like clinical psychology, where you do assessments for the courts and things like that.
Right. I started off back in the day studying mechanical engineering because I wasn't good. I was good at it, I guess. I just wanted a job. I just wanted to move out of my parents' home and have a career of some form. And I honestly didn't much care what. And I got into the undergraduate college that I got into. And I was like, cool, that's good enough. We're fine. And then my junior year, I got sick. I got a kidney infection and I was in the hospital. And this was back in the days of paper books. And someone brought me the book version of Mindhunter. And I remember reading it and thinking, this guy seems to like his job. This seems interesting. This is definitely not mechanical engineering. I could do this. I could try this. And ultimately, I decided I didn't want to become a profiler. I have a lot of conflicted feelings about profiling as a profession and how successful it can or should be. You know, it feels a little Minority Report at times. And I wanted to feel like I was in it more immediately, you know, not maybe gonna possibly find somebody, but I wanted to sit down with somebody who had actually done the thing and be like, please explain the thing to me.
Right. That's what I do.
And that's, you know, I, in my career, met three or four, and I worked in New Hampshire, so it's a small state. And I met three or four serial killers, none of which were anything like what you see in the movies.
Right.
None of which were especially smart or suave, because that makes people more memorable.
Right.
And also, at the end of the day, I realized, like, these are failures. They got caught. So yep. I can't study these people and know anything about serial killers. And you said it in a thing. You said it on Kate Winkler-Dawson, and shout out to her. She's wonderful. Tenfold More Wicked. I had listened to that over pandemic. So sometime last year, probably, about how serial killing is not itself a...
Serial killer isn't a criminal type. It is a description of an act of behavior. And people want to package it up as if serial killers are all the same and they all have specific key traits. And that isn't it. Serial killer is somebody who's killed at least on two different occasions, two people. That's it. That's it. There's nothing in there about motive, nothing, you know, in there about personalities or anything like that. There's a wide range of differences among them. So if you're setting out to understand a serial killer, you have to take it a case at a time. You can't do it generically. You can't. The number one question I get, I write a blog for Psychology Today, and I've been doing that for 10 years. And the number one question I get from especially high school and college kids is, what's the ratio between nature and nurture and serial killers? And like, A, no calculation. B, it's not a criminal type. C, even if you could measure and calculate this versus that, so what? It's not going to get you anywhere. That's not the way to approach what serial killer means. But it's really about cases. Who's Dennis Rader? How did he get to be a serial killer? Why did he want to continue to kill people and also be a family man? That's interesting. Who's Dean Corll? Why did he kill 27 boys and bury them in a boat shed? You're looking at cases, not at serial killer in a generic sense. But I, all too often, that's what I hear. What's the difference between male and female serial killers? As if, like, we're talking about thousands of people. You can't put it in a box like that. And yet, and that seems to be how people are approaching it.
And people, they desperately want it. And it, like, I understand it on some level, like, it would be comforting to have the McDonald triad be a thing.
Right.
For listeners, McDonald triad. Bedwetting. It's not. But the what the bedwetting, cruelty to animals, and fire setting. And that if you see a kid that does those three things, they're likely to be a serial killer, and most serial killers don't do those three things. Both of which are not correct, are not accurate. Right. We don't know.
You know,
serial killing is such a fringe activity. And I mean, you mentioned Rader. One of the things that I find fascinating, I guess, about him, even myself, who's spent some time in the room with other ones, is that he's one of few, not the only, but one of few, who seems like he set out before he ever, not just that he was fascinated by serial murder, but that he set out and decided, this is a thing that I am going to do.
He is one of the few who absolutely set that his mind to that because he wanted to become famous. He had looked at some True Detective magazines and saw them on the covers. He saw that what the kinds of things they did that were also things that that turned him on. And he latched onto that as part of his fantasy life. So he is one of the few. And it was before there was even the phrase serial killer when he came up with that.
Right. And you know, more often, like including, so the people, three of the people that I worked with, I don't have releases to speak about. Although, again, funny isn't the right word, but we'll go with funny. One of them has a full multi-part episode out about them. And boy, listening to that and being like, oh, you're talking about me. That's the thing that's happening right now in my life. That's weird, which is wild. And it's a person who, that one was male and didn't have any sort of, you wouldn't know if you saw him on the street, which is the point. That's how they get away with it more than once, is that they don't stand out. But one of the ones that I do have a signed release for, and even then I don't go into the clinical information, but I met and interacted relatively extensively with Sheila LaBar.
Oh,
right. And it's funny because, you know, the story that I tell about her is that, so New Hampshire being a small state and the men's facility is not very big and the women's facility is much, much smaller. So the women's facility didn't have a full-time mental health staff at all, much less clinical psychologist or forensic psychologist on staff. So whenever we needed to go up to Goffstown, I would just commute effectively from my job to my other job to the other location to see somebody. And so they wouldn't necessarily tell me who I was going to see. And that's cool. That's a lot of times I wouldn't know who it was. And so I was just sort of waiting on the yard and I was standing next to a corrections officer. And they're doing the sort of after lunch move of inmates that they do. And this one woman walks by and it's like, you're in a prison. Like potentially everybody's scary, but really they're just people.
Right. Right.
They're just people. No big. And I felt safer at that job than I felt in any other job that I had, pretty much. But this one woman walked by and she just had an aura to her. She just had an intensity. And I said to the CO, I was like, who is that? And the CO laughed at me. And I was like, I don't like that. that's not the reaction I want from you. And they're like, oh, you'll find out.
Yes.
And I sure did. And she is a person who doesn't behave like we think of. Women are poisoners. Women kill people they know. They kill family. Women, we had these stereotypes.
I don't think like that.
No. But but that's the stereotype. And she blew all of that out of the water. And her victims are still extraordinarily dead.
Yeah. Yeah, she was definitely an unusual one, for sure. And intense and delusional and all that. But what was it like for you to be talk with her?
I got married in the middle of my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I chose at that time to practice both for the obligatory time of doing therapy, which I'm terrible at. I don't like it. And then doing the forensic assessments, I chose to practice under my maiden name.
Nice.
And there's only about 3 or 4 people that I ever worked with where I'm like, I'm so glad.
She doesn't know you.
She doesn't know my, you know, and she is one of them. Where, and in fact, and another one I can think of was another woman, and I think that's coincidence, but still, there's just a rage and a sense of, I might not come after you now, but I could someday, you know. And I went home at night and I slept at night because you have to. You see the things you see, and you still have to function.
Yeah.
You know, and the like. But she was one where I was like, oh no, she doesn't blend.
Right.
Like, if she didn't blend in, you know, the community of Epping, New Hampshire, everybody knew she's messed up, steer clear of her. And so she's one where I look at like, nobody picked up on this, really? Nobody, no, actually they all picked up on it, just nobody said anything. Got it.
Yeah, she definitely took advantage of some vulnerable people.
Absolutely. And she is one, a side note from Sheila, is that she was never legally married to William LaBarre. She was legally married to a guy named Wayne Ennis. Shout out to Wayne. He listens to my podcast. So that's the thing that where I was like, wow, my two lives have just collided when I'm suddenly getting DMs from some random person. And I, you know, to the extent that you can, I believe he's who he says he is. And it's wild. And you know, and the vast majority of the people that I worked with are just people. They had a bad day and, you know, wrong place, wrong time, wrong emotions, wrong everything all at once. And there should be consequences to their actions, but I am not myself in favor of the death penalty. I have remained in the Northeast because one thing that people don't know about the clinical practice of forensic psychology is that if someone has been sentenced to death, they have to be assessed for competency for execution.
Right.
And I super didn't want to do that.
Tough. It's a tough position for sure. It's a such a weird ethics on that.
It really, I just couldn't untangle it. And so I was like, you know, I'm just going to live in non-death penalty states, and that's what it's going to be. And the vast majority of the people I worked with were, they're just people. And you look at them and you're like, that could be me. That mm-hmm. could be me. And once in a while, you look at somebody like Sheila and I'm like, no, that couldn't be me. That one of her well-known among a certain crowd quotes is the police officers did a wellness check at her house for Kenny County and saw what they believed were bones and asked her, what are those? And she was like, oh, well, I don't know. They're either bones from a rabbit or a pedophile. And me, I've never confused the two. So I feel like that puts me in a safe position away from becoming that.
It's a bizarre case, to be sure. It's a really unusual case.
It is. When you have interacted with serial killers or one-offs or whatever the crime is, do people assume that it is dangerous or that you are scared?
Yes, always. I'm never scared and I don't believe I'm in danger. But yeah, the assumption is that there are monsters 24/7 and always ready to pounce. Yep.
It's a wild thing. You know, the like I said, the safest job I ever had was
Well, but I think it's because they're presented on TV shows as predators, so they're always vigilant for their opportunities. They're always predating around and looking for victims. And so I can understand why that impression would be made on viewers who only see them in those kinds of settings. But, you know, when they're in prison incarcerated, they're not going to be doing that all the time. They really weren't doing it all the time when they were not in prison. And if they have some reason why they want to be talking to you and they want to keep your attention, of course, they are not going to scare you away. That's the last thing they want to do, because they need that legitimacy. They need that someone who's coming and listening to them. So there's, I guess that's still sort of predatory, but not in the monstrous way.
It's a, you know, it's a weird thing, because, you know, I after I left working in the prison, I went on to do crisis assessment in the emergency room and the like, because I had kids and kids ruin everything. And so the whole daycare thing was a challenge. And my husband is a professor, so his hours are prescribed. And so I decided I'm going to step out and I'm going to work doing crisis work in the emergency room, because you can do that 24/7. So he and I pretty much never saw each other, but, you know, that's fine. It meant the kids weren't in daycare all the time and the like. And those were the situations, the active crisis. Those were the situations when I felt in danger. Those were the situations when I was in either sort of I wasn't assaulted in a deliberate sense so much as collateral damage.
Yeah.
But I never felt stalked. I never felt threatened.
Well, I've been stalked, but not by the dangerous people.
Also that, yes. Yeah.
By and people you would never guess are the ones who've been my stalkers.
You have like a playing card list of stalkers.
I've had stalkers, but they are not any of the dangerous criminals that I've dealt with. They are an academic dean, for example, who got a fixation on me. Nobody would have ever guessed he was like that, but that's the nature of stalkers.
Yeah, well, I mean, the only one I feel a little bit left out, but no, I've had one. The only one I've had is it wasn't until after I started the podcast, and he didn't like one of my guests, so it didn't even have to do with me. It had to do with he disagreed with the attitude of my guests, and I was like, so stalk them. And then it turns out he was. So that was exciting. And so there's a shared restraining order.
Right.
About the and I was like, what a strange, like, because I say everybody, I know it's not everybody, but people tend to assume if I say stalker, they assume romantic.
Right. Only about 10% are erotomanic.
Yeah,
punitive, disfixated,
and that's what I try. You know, it's like life is dangerous,
right?
You know, and doing this job at least helps me understand the parameters of danger a little bit better.
Right? Did you end up doing assessments on Sheila? Did you have to do any assessments, or
I did?
Did she respond well, or
no?
She's narcissistic, obviously, so she likes the attention, but I would think she'd like the superiority.
Yeah, she didn't want attention from me.
Oh. Okay.
And one of the things is when I would do assessments, because, you know, the last thing I wanted, maybe not the last, but one of the last things I wanted was to have a bombshell moment in the courtroom. Like, court is profoundly boring, and it's supposed to be. You know, the last thing I wanted was to be on the stand and just say a thing and have the defendant freak out in some way. Like, that's not good. And so I made a point of you're not given just free rein, especially in New Hampshire is one of the states where there the prosecution can hire a forensic psychologist. The defense can hire, but I was an employee of the state, which meant they didn't care what answer I got, which was nice. because then it just means I just tell you what I see. And you either agree with me or you don't, but I don't have skin in the game. I don't need anyone to agree with me or otherwise. But in service of keeping the courtroom as boring as possible, I would make a point of, after I've done the evaluations, I've done whatever testing has to be done, I've written it up, I go back and I tell them, this is what I'm going to say on the stand. And in Sheila's case, I was not a part of her main event, you know, her primary, it was a subsequent hearing that happened, and it didn't get the press, which is fine by me. Like I was not there for the press of it all, and even brushing up against the side of it was like, I this is not what I am here to do, you know. And you're given a question to answer. Is this person competent to stand trial? What is their diagnosis? Are they being held in the best possible facility for them? Those sorts of questions, and you come up with an answer. And so it doesn't even always need testing. And I would go back then to the client or patient, depending on where they were kept. And I would say, this is what I'm going to say when I go on the stand. Or this is what I'm going to say when I go back to the state or to, you know, to whoever posed this question to me. Do you understand the words that I'm using? And does this seem fair? Like, you don't have to agree with me. But do you, like, am I completely off base? Do you see where I'm coming from? Because now's your time. I'm not going to argue with you when I'm on the stand. So now's your time if you're going to argue. And she wouldn't meet with me.
At all. Wow.
For that follow-up. She had made her mind that I was not going to say whatever it was she wanted. And she's probably correct that I didn't say, nice things.
Were you doing the assessment for the court or for her attorney or for the prosecution?
For the court.
Okay.
For the court.
Yeah. So she couldn't make you do anything.
There was no benefit to her one way or the other. And I think that there was a certain degree of curiosity, and she was impelled by the state to show up for an evaluation. But you can't pull words out of somebody. Yeah, and I, you know, I made a point of telling everybody that too. Like, look, I can't force words out of you. You can sit here in complete silence for the next 8 hours. You can do that thing. I can too. You tell me. And I think realize, you know, in a comparable situation, who I also have a signed release for, was I worked on a reevaluation of Pamela Smart. She's something. And she absolutely wanted to speak more than once, and she wanted in depth, and she wanted me to rewrite things and put her in the best possible light. And I was like, that's also not my job.
Right.
You know, but nice to meet you, I guess, you know, and it's just such an odd, like, it's fascinating when I understand the desire for control. I would want to have control too. But what they don't seem to get is that the more that they talk, the more that they're showing me.
Right.
And that if you truly want to control the situation, you don't say anything.
Right. Well, a lot of them talk because they think the words will control the narrative and that they'll somehow manage to get you to believe what they want you to believe, because in the words is the power for them. And they really don't understand that layer of behavior where we see more than just what they're saying. We're seeing how they relate to their words and how they relate to us and their blind spots and all of that. And they don't get that because they're so firmly entrenched in the words as their weapons, as their methodology.
Absolutely. And I would, you know, I remember looking at Pammy, as she preferred to be called, and which was amusing to me at the time because my mother's name is Pamela, and my mother might inflict mortal wounds if you called her Pammy. And
well, but there's the little girl.
And Pammy was very like, you know, I want people to like me. And I'm like, you're in prison. You know, and she wasn't, by this point, she had already been rehoused to New York State because of some of the issues that had gone on between her and one of the prison guards in Goffstown. And she was just back briefly. So I'm like, why do you care mm-hmm. whether or not I like you? But that's how her world had whittled down, that she had so little control that just feeling like she had the control over whether someone liked her or seemed to like her was enough for her. You know, I mean, you know Rader well.
Yeah.
You know, you've met other either yes. famous or infamous people for a different reason, for non-clinical reasons. You don't have to tiptoe in the ways that sometimes I have to tiptoe.
Right.
So
right.
you can just say, and you can refuse to answer. That's totally cool. But have there been surprises for you in you know, what you expected to see versus what you saw in their personality or in their style?
Yeah, sometimes I go in with a goal of getting, you know, just simply to get to know them and some of the things that they're going through, and suddenly I'm a therapist, which is not what I went in for. But that's always interesting too. I'm happy to do that because that will get me a very different perspective on them. I think occasionally they'll say something that they didn't expect to say, like, I've never told anyone this kind of thing. I always like those moments because that shows trust or manipulation, depending on the context. But I don't think I get much surprise because I usually get as prepared as possible before I go to see them. And I think you have to do that because they will try to take advantage of any gaps in your awareness of them or your knowledge of them. So I always try to be just as, you know, to really know the details of their case before I start asking questions, because if they contradict those details, you know, I'll have hard evidence to go back to and say, are you sure you don't want to read your statement again on this point? Because you said this. So I think, because I'm prepared, there's not much room for surprises.
Again, you know, I am not a fan of the surprise in the workplace, so I follow. I had more surprises, I think, in dealing with people outside, you know, whether it's the support staff at the prison or people on the all the way outside
yeah.
interacting with me. I had a certain assumption that I was inherently ghoulish or morbid or sensationalistic or voyeuristic because I wanted to see. And I'm like, look, my favorite part of the day is not paging through someone's crime scene photos. You just have to do that as part of the case sometimes.
Right.
And I think the number of people who were just simply surprised that a woman could be a forensic psychologist, that you could do this work and in immerse yourself in this work. I get a lot of questions still now. I get a lot of questions about how did you cope emotionally? And I'm like, you're assuming I'm not a sociopath, aren't you?
Right.
Like, why do we assume that it bothered me in the first place? Like, of course it did sometimes, but it's also just my job.
Yeah, they don't understand the clinical perspective, that you can look at these things with a professional distance and not get completely overwhelmed by it. I think the hardest part of all of this, I think, is dealing with victims' family members. I think that's the hardest because they expect something from you. They expect you to do things. They expect you to say things. But that's not really what you're there for. You're not. But they want something, and they'll never get what they want because they want their loved one back, or they want absolute justice, or, you know, whatever it is. I found that to be probably the hardest part of all this.
Yeah, there's I have a hard time, for very similar reasons, talking to the families of perpetrators. A little bit more, it depends on the family and it depends on the perpetrator, but there was often this question of, what did I do wrong? What could I have done better? That sort of approach.
For
and
sure,
the answer
yeah.
is,
Am I to blame?
I don't know. Like, I
look, Jeffrey Dahmer's father wrote a whole book about it. Am I to blame? You know, the always searching for what in the world could my fathering style have been to produce this kind of behavior. So, yeah, I think, you know, you have no answers for them either, really.
And remembering that, like, I used to just sort of indiscriminately, I would read and watch and listen to true crime as a genre because it's where my heart lies. And so when I went on disability, I was like, I missed that. I want to listen to that. And I was familiar. You mentioned earlier the True Detective magazines and those right. sorts of things. Like, I was familiar that with those, that they existed. But for me, when I got drawn in, I just went straight for, let's make this an actual career, not lurid headlines. And it wasn't for me until after I had left the field that I realized how intensely sensationalistic and gross it can feel sometimes, you know. And in 2019, I was at a convention of sorts. It wasn't CrimeCon, but it was a parallel to that. And friends of mine and I decided to put on a live show. They are both defense attorneys for sensitive crimes. I've got the forensic psychology. And so they presented the Leopold and Loeb case. And right. I had some commentary on that, but that was there. And I presented Ed Gein because the convention was in Chicago, so Leopold and Loeb, and they are defense attorneys in Wisconsin.
Okay. And
so Mendota in Wisconsin right. is where right, Ed right. Gein mm-hmm. ended up. And I was the day of this live show, I'm sort of just reviewing, you know, what I want to go over and whatever. And I had my laptop open and someone walked behind me and came to like this just abrupt stop. And I turn around and it's another podcaster. And I felt bad because I was like, oh, you didn't, I'm looking at full on crime scene photos in this particular moment. Right. It's one thing to hear the words. It's another thing to see.
Right.
The things. And I apologized. I was like, and they're like, no, that's cool. And I was like, ooh, this is there are two kinds of people in the world moment.
Right.
Because it's not cool. Right. And I didn't get into this because it's cool or interesting. And my sense from you, both from your work and from talking to you now, is that you're not in it because it's just fascinating and you want to sit around and drink wine and talk about terrible things, like that you're trying to impact the world.
I'm trying to understand, penetrate mysteries and open things up in a way that will benefit us in our field.
How do you navigate that when people get fangirly or, oh, that's cool about crime?
Depends on the situation, but I do try to ask them to consider the victim's families and do they think it's cool or they think that this is funny, that it, you know, because there's a lot of funny things out there too that people consider morbid humor, but it's at the expense of victims. And so I always try to get them to think with some perspective. Usually they recognize what I'm saying. I don't think it's cool. I don't know how it got to be cool. So I don't have an understanding of that. I'm happy to answer questions for people if they really want to know how someone developed and how could someone do these things. But yeah, I don't really share in that this is so cool kind of thing. It's weird. Like I know some of the podcasts, and I'm not going to name any, but some of them chatter on and giggle and laugh over things that have happened to people. And I don't understand that. I just don't get it.
It doesn't work for me. Even when they make a point, I don't even like the ones where, and I don't listen to them, so I can't name them anymore, but where they say bad things about the bad guy, visual quotes on that, and good things about the victim. And I'm like, you've just destroyed the complexity and the humanity of both sides. That the bad guy did bad things. Yes. Mm-hmm. Should have consequences. Yes. But also has a family and might someday be back out on the street. And so punishing this person to the point where they lose all empathy may not be to your benefit.
Right.
And meanwhile, as a, you know, as a person walking around in the world, I'm not, like, I don't deserve to be assaulted or murdered. Nobody does. But I don't, me personally, like, I'm doing a pretty good job leading a pretty good life and caring for people that I love and finding a hobby that tries to tap into some empathy and the like. That being said, let's pretend that tomorrow I am assaulted or killed. I don't want anyone to say, she was an innocent victim and her smile lit up the room when she walked in. Because I'm not innocent either. I'm not perfect. And I'm often sarcastic and I'm kind of obnoxious sometimes. Those are all true things.
Well, I think people like the simplistic views of the world. I think they like categories that are clear and distinct and predictable. And I think that just makes them feel safe.
Yeah, I think so. And so if you were given the magic wand to get rid of one or several, I don't care, it's your magic wand, misconceptions about crime and those who commit it, what do you get rid of?
That kids who kill are bad for life. I think we know a lot about the adolescent brain now. We need to understand more about what was going on in their life and the fact that they might not be incorrigible for the rest of their life. That's one that I just wrote a blog about that. I'd get rid of that serial killers want to be caught. I hear that one all the time. No, they don't. They want to do what they're doing. There's very few who turn themselves in, and they always have that option if they really want to be caught. I just heard one last week that because we have genealogical DNA capabilities now, we will eradicate all serial murder in the future. Like, what?
That's optimistic.
Well, it's also ridiculous because they assume that serial killers believe they're going to get caught. They don't believe that, no matter what tools you have, but they also can study it themselves and see what they can do to avoid leaving their DNA in various places. So I think I hear people make predictions like that, or they make huge generalizations about the population of offenders, like mass murderers or serial killers. And I just wish people were better at nuance, because human beings have a lot more layers to them than many of our crime categories allow. So there's my magic wand moment.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
There's any number of lessons I could walk you out with from this episode. The importance of nuance, the helpfulness of bliss. Man, I don't know if she did that on purpose or not, by the way, but I did some internal dancing when she used that word. I was like, yeah, you did. But the message I'm going to sit with is go ahead and ask. If there's somebody you really want to talk to, go ahead and ask. I've had people say no to me, that they either didn't feel my show was right for them or they didn't have time. I've had people not answer when I've reached out and asked them to come on. So it's not a magic thing. It's not like, oh, everybody I've ever asked has leapt all over themselves to come on Ignorance Was Bliss. But, like in this case, Catherine wasn't on my show before. And so if I hadn't asked, she still would not have been on my show. It took asking, and there's a fear there, and there's a vulnerability there. And when she said yes, I absolutely had some moments of complete lack of dignity, being like, oh my God, she said yes. Ooh, that's this person who was inside my television is going to talk to me on my very own computer. Holy cow. You know. It was not a dignified moment for me, but it was so great, and all because I asked. So I don't know exactly if there's a situation in your life where you're afraid to ask because you're afraid they'll tell you no. I'm telling you, I walk into everything expecting to be told no in the first place, so maybe I just have a low bar for expectation, but man, when somebody whose work you admire says yes, it's such a kick. It's just, it made my whole summer, and my summer was rough. So knowing that I had this episode kind of in my pocket, and one of these days I could get my act together and I could release it, really helped. And besides, I think it's worth asking, because you know the drill, right? You matter.